S-A-B-O-O, San Francisco, baby, baby!
Shibba, shibba! Shibba, shibba! Shibba, shibba!
Let me in!
Shibba, shibba!
I wanna be closer to you!
Shibba, shibba!
Open up your soul!
Shibba, shibba!
Let me find that part of you! The part that nobody ever knew.
Let me touch your mind.
Oh, why don't you let me in? Let me be the first to ever touch your mind.
Hello. And welcome to Let Me Touch Your Mind, the show where we try to get you to be something, do something, experience something, enjoy something, or if it's the first Monday of the year, understand something. Happy New Year, everyone. I've got a fresh-faced the science envoy here to talk about the stars, the firmament, and all of the things that people want to discover in the sky. I'd like to welcome Natasha Abrams. Hello.
Hello. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'm so glad you are here. So, Natasha, tell me a little bit about you. When did you first get bit by the science bug?
Yeah, so I've always been interested in science. I grew up loving my math classes, loving my science classes, and, you know, looking up to the stars. You know, in I think middle school, I started with Science Olympiad and the reach for the –
What's Science Olympiad?
It's like a I guess a competition for in all sorts of types of science, you know, regionally, and it can go up to nationally or statewide, et cetera. And yeah, I did the Reach for the Stars event.
Oh,
and
cool.
That was the first time I kind of knew you could study astronomy formally and kind of been running with it ever since.
Okay, so were you one of those kids that was constantly asking your parents about things, and did they have answers for you, or did they buy you books that had the answers, or how did that work?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I definitely asked about, you know, everything, and you know, to various degrees, they either would know the answer or would sometimes make up an answer, but say that they were making it up afterward, and we'd, you know, especially my dad on stuff like that, and my mom more on the kind of history and stuff side, and yeah.
So when your dad made up the answer, at a certain point, did you look at him all the time going, is that true?
Absolutely.
Well, yeah. which gave you scientific skepticism.
Yeah.
So in a way, you know, hooray, Dad. But at what point, so you said you did the Olympiad and you discovered, but at what point did you realize in school that you really liked the sciences?
I don't remember a time I didn't, I guess.
Oh, okay.
I don't know. I think math and science are quite intertwined, and like math was definitely my favorite subject.
Okay.
Like,
do you love numbers?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Oh, okay. So, because I met a person a long time ago, and I was like, why are you an accountant? And she's like, because I love numbers. And I was thinking, that's the person you want to have working for you as someone who loves what they do. So you got excited when you found out that you had to go through the math before you could get to the science, right?
Yeah, especially I think in general when you do science, like oftentimes you learn the same thing again and again and like increase complexity.
Mm-hmm.
And so like when I was doing physics in high school, like the first time I learned physics, you know, they didn't have calculus in it. But then the next time when there was calculus in it, it was like, oh my God, this makes so much more sense. Like, because it's kind of like math is often the language that describes.
So when you were doing physics in high school, they didn't have calculus in it?
For the first time, in my school, they had us take it twice in junior year and then senior year, or sometimes sophomore year and the senior year.
So then, because you're saying, you know, it made more sense once you had calculus.
Yeah.
So was it just impenetrable the first time around?
I guess it wasn't impenetrable, but you just kind of have to abstract away a lot of what's going on. If you need, if you don't have like the full math, you're like, okay, well then you have to take this equation as given and run with that without a deeper understanding. Whereas when you like include calculus, you can like derive the equations yourself and see where it comes from, and everything kind of click together better.
Because I would imagine, you know, for that first round, it would discourage a lot of people because it wouldn't quite make sense. You wouldn't necessarily know that, oh, it's all going to make sense. It seems like they should teach the calculus first and then the physics, but that's just me.
Yeah, I think that there's benefits to either way. I think you can definitely understand some of like the phenomenon without understanding calculus. And to understand calculus, you have to have a pretty substantial math background. Mm-hmm. Whereas I think that some of the phenomenon you can understand, like, you know, friction, for example, like, you know, when like motion in general, you can understand like these sorts of things without understanding the deep math. But as someone who wanted to question these things, just being like handed equation and being like, okay, just this is it and go on from there, made me want to understand more.
Okay. So fast forward, you're in college now. Mm-hmm. You are studying math and astronomy simultaneously. Is that how it works?
So I actually didn't take too many math classes in college. I guess I did a like joint major in astrophysics and physics, technically.
Okay.
But yeah, I took a couple.
She says that so casually. Oh, joint major in astrophysics and physics, you know, like as one does.
It's fun. but yeah, so there were like, I think, a couple more moments where like a math class directly informed like multivariable calculus for electromagnetism, which is like, you know, the studies are both like of circuits, but basically anything that has electric charge or magnets can be described by that. And understanding multivariable calculus is really necessary to understand where those equations came from.
So when you're in college and you're studying astronomy and math, is it definitely with the eye on staying in astronomy, or does something reveal itself to you that says, I can stay in astronomy?
Yeah, so I actually got very lucky and was able to start doing research in high school, which is pretty rare. I basically emailed a ton of professors in the area, and a professor at the Natural History Museum, Ari Mahler, agreed to do research with him. And
I love that. You're just like, you know what? How old were you when you decided to do that?
So I was 15. There was like this science research program. But everyone was like, oh, we have connections to people in chemistry. Why don't you talk to them? And I was like, oh, but I really been bit by this astronomy bug.
Right.
And so there was some guidance. Mm-hmm. It's also some self-motivation.
But that's so proactive. Yeah. I mean, that you're just taking the bull by the horns and saying, I really want to do this. Yeah. I'm going to write people. I love that determination to pursue the sciences in that way. So you did the research. And what kind of research was it?
So it was about galaxies.
Okay.
I guess about the morphology of galaxies, like this.
What's morphology?
Like the shape of galaxies.
Okay.
And kind of understanding the. So there's this survey called the Sloan Digital Sky Survey that looks at tons of galaxies. And broadly, galaxies fall into two different types, spiral galaxies and elliptical galaxies.
Okay.
Where spirals are flat and have these big kind of spiral arms.
Okay.
And elliptical galaxies, which are kind of this like big clump of stars.
Okay.
And
like an egg almost?
Yeah.
Okay.
Like a football
or a pill or something. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
All right.
And
how do you get those two different shapes?
So we think that one evolves to the other. We think that the spiral galaxies become elliptical galaxies over time.
Oh, you mean there's a gravitational pull that
Yeah, so there's we think that sometimes that mergers might make that happen. So if two spiral galaxies come together, all the stars are stirred up, and instead of going back into that flat disk, they might then become this kind of more puffed up, more random movements of stars.
So you were that's what you were researching in high school.
Okay. Yeah, like ones that didn't quite fall into either category.
Oh, so those ones that don't fall in either category, do they think that they are morphing from one to the other?
Okay. Either maybe they just went through a merger. That's, yeah, the typical.
And did you know about those things before you got into research, or was that your first time exposed to that?
Some of it I knew before, like from the Science Olympiad, studying for that, like, science competition. But a lot of it I learned in, while doing research, or, you know, my mentor showed me papers to read and stuff like that.
So did that foundation of having already done research give you a leg up when you were trying to find astronomy things to do, you know, postgraduate?
Yeah, I think it certainly did in a number of ways. I mean, first off, it increased my confidence because, you know, I got, you know, 20 professors who either didn't respond or said no. And then
you just need one.
Yeah, just need one. And so I think it gave me confidence to reach out to professors and to, to reach out to professors and to, like, you know, go to office hours, make, like, the connections, both, like, you know, make connections, but also, you know, ask them about their research during office hours, which I think people were sometimes afraid to do. And then also the confidence that I know that I like research. I think a lot of people go in and they don't know if they want to do it or not. And so they don't want to commit too much.
Okay.
But I knew that I wanted to. And so that helped a lot.
Okay. So when you were first writing to professors as a teen,
yeah,
was it an idea you came up with on your own, or did someone guide you? Did someone say, hey, why don't you just do this?
Yeah. So the it was more the latter.
Okay.
Where they encouraged you, like, you know, to read their papers and to potentially ask questions about their papers. I think that that is often more approachable than just, like, you sending some generic email to some professor.
Sure,
like,
because
they often will have so many, like, so many people trying to reach out to them. So, like, showing, I'm interested in your research specifically.
And the reason I ask is because I know that there are people who are listening who may have people in their lives who want to pursue some sort of scientific endeavor, but don't have that confidence, and they could just say, you know what, you can just do this. And so I love that someone gave you that advice, and it panned out so beautifully for you.
Yeah.
So you graduate. Do you go immediately into research, or what's your path outside once you get your degree?
So I went, straight from high school to college, and then college to grad school, and that's where I am now.
Okay. And you're doing research. And tell our listeners a little bit about what the research is.
Yeah. So I'm looking for black holes using gravitational lensing.
Okay. Now, I don't know if you know this, but when I was a kid, one of the big boogaboos outside of, you know, nuclear war and, you know, assured mass destruction was that a black hole would suck the Earth in and we'd all die. And when you know, because every generation has their sort of like that big overarching fear.
Sure.
So for my older listeners who grew up with that, dispel that fear.
Yeah. So one thing I like to say is, if the sun became a black hole tomorrow, besides the fact that there would be no light, which, and, you know, we died that way, but if the sun became a black hole, we would not get sucked in. We would just keep going around. If it were the same mass as our sun, we're in a stable orbit around it. Black holes aren't these magical things that suck things in. They're, you know, they have a certain mass and they exert a certain amount of gravity. And if you get very, very close, you won't be able to escape.
Mm-hmm.
But if you are very far away from one and, you know, we're, you know, at least 1,000 or from ones that we know of, there's where, you know, light would take 1,000 years to get to the nearest black hole. And yeah, there's no black hole that's going to pop up and suck in the Earth or anything like that.
Okay. Because I remember them saying that, oh, like a tiny piece of black hole could break off and smash into the Earth and we'd all be sucked. And, you know, and you just, as a kid, you're kind of terrorized by it.
Sure.
So for our listeners, what is a black hole?
So a black hole is a very massive, dense object. And mm-hmm. so basically there's this concept of escape speed.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you jump on Earth, you don't go flying out into space.
Yeah.
That's because Earth is holding you and keeping
gravity.
You from doing that.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas we have rockets that if they're going fast enough, they can escape Earth's gravitational pull.
Okay.
With a black hole, the idea is light, which is goes the fastest that we know as possible, the fastest, you know, the speed of light is the cosmic speed limit.
Mm-hmm.
Even light cannot escape a black hole. And that's why it's black, is because any light that is close enough is not going to be able to escape and reach our eyes. And yeah.
Okay. So I think that is the whole part. Is it because when people looked out and saw, did they think it was a hole? Or why is it called a black hole as opposed to a black mass? Or?
Sure. I don't actually know the history of the word of black holes. I think that they were theorized before we ever discovered them.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, because you can't see them, you don't often you'll just see their gravitational influence,
mm-hmm.
Rather than, you know, seeing just like this empty void in the sky.
Does it kind of look like a dark hole that things are pouring into, like a drain?
Yeah. So in some ways, so like you might have heard of there was a picture of the black hole taken a couple years ago by the Event Horizon Telescope.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of does look like a, you know, dark spot that around it is what's called an accretion disk.
What's that?
An accretion disk is basically, you know, to accrete is when material pours onto the black hole.
Okay.
Like a drain, kind of.
Okay.
And it ends up lighting up because all of the, like, gas in that disk rubs together. Yeah.
Okay.
It rubs together. And basically, because of the friction, will light up and mm-hmm. glow. And you can see that glow.
That's really cool. Have you seen that?
I mean, no one has seen it with their eyes.
No,
but
no.
I've seen pictures of it. Yeah.
So how did they find it?
Yeah. So there's, I guess, kind of two classes of black holes. There's ones that are closer to the mass of our sun to about 100 or from like maybe 3 times the mass of our sun to
mm-hmm.
about 100, 150 times the mass of our sun. And then there's ones that are super massive black holes
mm-hmm.
that are at least 1,000,000 times the mass of our sun.
Wow.
And so at the center of every galaxy, as far as we know, there is a supermassive black hole.
Of every galaxy?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So even the one
even ours, yeah.
Oh, okay.
The one in ours is called Sagittarius A star.
Wow.
And so once that inference was made, in part from in our galaxy being able to trace the star's orbits
mm-hmm.
around the central black hole and being able to infer there must be something very massive there.
Mm-hmm.
And then in others, you can see the glow of the accretion disk, and you can also see what's called a quasar, which is basically when the material that's in the accretion disk ends up getting shot out in these really bright jets.
Oh, okay.
They can outshine their whole galaxy.
Oh, wow.
And so these black holes make themselves known.
Oh, okay.
And so the material doesn't get to the point where light can't escape, because otherwise, you know, it's a black hole. Light can't escape past a certain point. Sure. But it's kind of fueling this engine of, you know, shooting out this light. And so we're able to infer their presence or to see their presence. Mm-hmm. And that we're able to find them. So there's the supermassive black hole side. You can just really see them in some ways. And then for the ones that are closer to our sun's mass, you can see sometimes if a black hole is in a binary with a star.
Okay.
That means when they're orbiting one another.
Would the star have to be as big as the black hole to... Oh, okay.
It does. Yeah, it might be the same size. It might be a little bit less massive.
But it doesn't get, you know, sucked in.
Yeah, if it's far enough away, it won't get sucked in.
Okay.
But sometimes the black hole will actually accrete parts of the star. So kind of like eat parts of the star.
Oh.
And that will glow. And so there's about, you know, 24 of those in the Milky Way.
Really?
That we've been able to see in the X-rays. So in that way, I don't know if you count that as seeing it as an accretion disk. But
yeah, I count that.
I think so, yeah.
I think so, too.
Yeah.
I want to go back just for a moment.
Yeah.
So you talked about how every galaxy has a black hole, and the black hole is kind of like, I would say it's misnamed because it's not actually a hole. It's just this dense material.
Yeah.
So, is the black hole providing energy for the galaxy, or is it just sort of hold? Is it just kind of like a like holding things in place within the galaxy? Like, and you said all galaxies have a black hole.
Yeah. So. You can do the math to try and figure out what kind of the sphere of influence of the black hole is, like, gravitationally.
Mm-hmm.
You can see that, I forget the exact number, but not nearly all of the galaxies influence it. If you look at the gravitational influence of stars by other stars or the other material in the galaxy versus the central supermassive black hole, then I think it was on order like 10 or 20% of the inner radius is influenced more by the central black hole than the other stars. But once you get past that, it's really just the gravity of all of the objects together that's holding it in place.
Oh.
So gravitationally, that's the story. Energetically, I think it's a little bit – it's still under debate, actually, whether if the black hole – is accreting a lot of material and you have it like an active black hole is what you would call it. If it's accreting material, if it's shooting out material as a quasar, if that quenches star formation, if that makes it so that stars are less likely to form because there's more of the gas being funneled, or if it makes star formation more likely to happen, if it's stirring up the gas and therefore allowing more stars to form. It's still an open question.
Okay. Well, I have another question.
Yeah.
So you've got this black hole. And it's exerting so much gravitational pull, but the ones that are really big don't get sucked in. So the closer you are to the – is it that the closer you are to a black hole, the larger the objects are that are around it? Or is it that the accumulated gravitational pull of all the things that are closest to it keep them from getting drawn closer?
Yeah, so – I guess in some ways a black hole is not different than other gravitational objects, right? Like remember when I said this, if the sun became a black hole, we wouldn't just get sucked in. So if you can have a stable orbit around a black hole.
Okay.
And so like if you if your initial velocity is fast enough, you know, you can calculate at each radius how far away you are from the black hole, how fast you would need to be going to be in a stable orbit around that black hole.
Okay.
It doesn't necessarily have to do with the other objects.
Okay. Okay. So, all right. So I'm still working from the paradigm of everything's going to get sucked in. Okay. Okay. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to 89.5 FM KPOO San Francisco. Who is touching your mind right now? I have my science envoy from Wonderfest, Natasha Abrams, talking about the firmament, the stars, gravitational pulls of black holes. And now in looking, you're working on a photometric micro lensing with large surveys. I don't know what any of those words mean. So can you just explain it to me as though I were 8 years old?
Absolutely. So I look at black holes that are closer to the mass of our sun.
Oh, okay.
Or I guess first let me say what gravitational lensing is.
Mm-hmm.
So gravitational lensing is when you have a massive object and it bends light from objects behind it in our line of sight.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so...
Are there any examples of that are on Earth, or is it all up in the sky?
Yeah, no, there's nothing massive enough on Earth for us to see any effect like that.
Okay. But is it kind of like a funhouse mirror out there?
Yeah. What's it called? One of my undergrad students that I've been supervising likes to call it a funhouse mirror.
Oh, okay.
Like, yeah. So basically, so when a black hole passes in front of a star, it's going to bend the light. It's bending the space-time around itself. And so the light follows the path in that bent space-time. And extra light gets bent towards us. It's like the black hole is acting like a lens in front of that star. So hence gravitational lensing.
Uh-huh. Okay.
We'll bend that light towards us. And we see that original star get brighter and dimmer as the black hole passes in front of it.
Oh, and how do you know that it is a black hole passing in front of it and not something else that is affecting the light?
Yeah, so that is a great question. That is, it is really not easy.
Oh.
Because basically, you can calculate how long that event will last as the black hole passes in front of a star or something like that. Or a star passes in front of another star. The star can also do lensing.
Sure, sure, sure.
And so you can calculate how long that will be. And that goes – the time scale of the event goes as the square root of the mass of the lens. So the more massive your lens is, the longer that the time scale of the event will be. You can think of it like a more massive object has like a bigger area of effect.
Sure, sure, sure.
So if you were just saying that, it'd be like, okay, well, the more massive objects just have the longer events, right?
Mm-hmm.
But they could also be moving slowly. Like you could just have a really slow, very not massive star moving in front.
It's just strolling along.
Yep. And that can look the same as a more massive object, a more massive black hole going in front of it. And so, yeah.
Does a black hole have a particular signature that alerts you that, oh, this is a black hole as opposed to just a lazy star?
Yeah. So there's a few different things we can do. If you just have the photometric signal, so that's the light over time, then you can if you just have the photometric signal, then if you get – like 1,000 of events and put them all together, then you can statistically say these over here are more likely to be black holes.
Okay.
But you can't just say this one is definitely a black hole.
Got it.
But there's another effect called astrometric microlensing, which is that not only does the original star appear to get brighter and dimmer, and it also appears to do a little wiggle as the light is being bent.
Would it not do that with another star, the wiggle?
So there's other ways that it could potentially – or you mean if a star passed in front of it as a lens?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The wiggle just happens with the black hole?
No, it also happens with the star, but it happens more with the black hole. And it's not based on the velocity of the objects. So if you see both the photometric effect being really long and a really big wiggle, then you can say –
that's probably a black hole.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. But that sounds kind of frustrating to try and suss out, well, is it really a black hole? Do people ever argue and go, I don't think that's a black hole. You're full of it.
Yeah. So there's been one isolated black hole found via this method by, I guess, two different groups. And so one was by she recently graduated student from Berkeley, Casey Lam, and another Kailash Sahu at the Space Telescope Science Institute. And they actually, at some point, disagreed, actually. So from our group, we thought it could be a black hole, it could be a neutron star, which is basically a very dense star, one step above a black hole.
Oh, okay.
And they were like, oh, it's definitely a black hole. And then after going through in detail, because the data analysis for this stuff is so, like, basically there's, like, this really bright star nearby, and that makes it so, in this particular case, there was a really bright star nearby, which made it really difficult to measure the wiggle. And so when when Casey went through in more detail with a new software package, then it was revealed that this is probably a black hole. But this stuff is, at the moment, so detailed. And it is really easy to not, like, I wouldn't even say it's, like, mistake. It's, like, when you're taking into account all these effects, it's really easy to, you know, get divergent answers.
Sure, sure. Because there's so many factors that are affecting it. It's like, well, is that this or is that that?
Yeah, exactly.
That's crazy. So you also said understanding how binaries impact our statistical understanding of the events that you discover. So binaries, is that the stars and the black holes orbiting each other? Is that what you're referring to as binaries?
Yeah, so either two stars orbiting each other, or a star and black hole, two black holes, so anything like that. So basically when people will do a microlensing survey, so that means just basically looking over the whole sky and trying to search for microlensing events, then they're seeing so many objects that it's typically people will typically just treat it as there's one star as the lens and one star as the source. And unless there's something that looks really funky, and sometimes it can look very funky, people will just assume that it's just a single star and a single lens and a single source. So I've been working on this simulation. It's called Popsicle.
Okay.
Popsicle. Okay. Neural popsicle. To basically simulate a little patch of the Milky Way. And in that patch of the Milky Way, in that patch of the Milky Way, then you can do a mock microlensing survey. So you simulate all the stars and the black holes and everything in one little patch, and then you can have them all pass by each other.
And does that little patch have its own black hole?
So this is like basically if you imagine we're sitting in the Milky Way, right? And so there's like you can see across the sky all different stars. And so basically we're taking a little slice of that sky and simulating that little patch. And so it's not a full galaxy in itself. It's like actually just a patch of stars in the Milky Way.
Just a random boop. This is what we're going to look over here.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. You know, we have it go through a couple of years, like so, you know, 5-year survey, and we can see which objects pass by each other.
So this is a piece of research that's been going on for several years? Okay, continue.
Yeah. Basically, what I did is I modified the software to include binary stars and binary black holes and all this. And what we found is that a much higher fraction of the microlensing events had a binary in them than previously thought.
Oh,
so there's a bunch of them that look like they could be singles, like just a single source and a single lens. There's not like a strong microlensing, a binary microlensing signal, but they secretly have a binaries in them.
Your and stealth binaries.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow. That just seems, it seems so complicated because you've got the visual noise from the other and the gravitational pull from the other stars. You've got a black hole that may or may not be there. You've got all of these possibilities. So how do you get footing when there's so many things that it could not be?
Exactly. There's this whole other set of, I guess, confounding things that we didn't even talk about, which is that stars vary on their own. Like, they do their own thing. They'll sometimes...
But they're going to wander?
They move, but they also, like, internally change their brightness sometimes because of their internal... for a few different reasons. It could be just, like, their internal chemistry could make them get brighter and dimmer over time. It could be that they have sunspots, or star spots, which is basically, like, a dark spot that moves around. Mm-hmm. They all have their own different variability.
Their personality.
Exactly, yeah.
Do stars ever sometimes look like they're breathing, like they're getting bigger and
yes.
small?
Yes.
Really?
Yes. There's a few different, it's called pulsating variable stars.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And it can happen like on hours time scales.
Wow. See, I think about seeing all of that and it would just confuse me. I would just be like, well, yesterday it was, 1.2 centimeters and now it's 1.24 centimeters and now it's 0.9. I would find it frustrating.
Sure. I and science in general benefits from like knowledge of previous people who've done things. Mm-hmm. And so, you got to start somewhere and you go step at a time. Okay. So microlensing isn't periodic, right? It's not like these stars breathing. It only happens once. And so you can say, okay, if I'm looking for a needle in a haystack, right? I'm looking for microlensing events in a survey where we looked at, a billion stars.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to look through and I'm going to take everything that's periodic, throw it in the trash can. Someone else can look at that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. No, not actually throw it in the trash can.
I know what you mean.
That's for someone who's interested in periodic variable stars.
Sure, sure, sure.
And then you can say, I have a microlensing model. You can write down the equation for what the model would look like, and you can say, okay, I'm going to fit each of these events, or I'm going to fit all of the stars' light curves to this model, and if it doesn't fit well to the model, into the trash can. You can keep on going and doing this until you get to a sample that you're pretty confident is microlensing events. Then if you want black hole microlensing events, then you have to go even further and you have to say, well, it's too expensive to get astrometric data for all of these. So which one of these are good candidates?
Question.
Yes.
So we know that they're binaries.
Uh-huh.
But are there ever any that it's like a triad? That there's
yes.
like really?
Yes, yes, yes.
And how do you deal with that?
Yeah, that's a great question.
Because it just seems, because from, I know from that Netflix thing of the three body problem, like you can predict things when it's just two, but once you add a third into the mix, all bets are off.
Yeah, so we can make simplifying assumptions. It's hard. I guess it depends exactly what you want to do. If you have a microlensing event that you're trying to fit with a binary light curve isn't working, then you can add in a third body, and you can just have it just sit there stationary.
Mm-hmm.
That's like the kind of first order thing. Is it's a triple, but it's moving slowly enough that over the course of the, could be 20 days, it could be a year-long microlensing event, maybe they're not moving enough that we don't have to care about how it's orbiting.
Okay.
And so you don't have to deal with a chaotic three-body problem.
But how soon does it reveal itself that it's three bodies and not two?
Sometimes it doesn't, right? Sometimes if the third body is like really far away from the other two.
You think it's just a binary and...
Yeah.
Gosh.
It's really hard. And so that's why the like simulation work is really important.
Uh-huh.
Because when you have the light curve, the light over time, mm-hmm. you might say, well, that looks like a single source and a single lens. And it's, you know, that's just what it looks like. But then you know, well, a certain fraction of the ones that look like that are actually going to have the binary companion, or a certain fraction of the binary ones that look binary are going to look like they're going to actually have a triple companion that are too far away or too close. Like if they're all three or really close together, it might mm-hmm. just look like one object. They might, the light from all three of them might be blended together or something like that. And so when you have the simulation work, then you can actually interpret those light curves, and you can say, okay, you can say, well, we've modeled it this way, but we mm-hmm. think that when we're interpreting the population of all the objects, this is how we think this fraction of them might be contaminated or okay. whatever.
So the modeling that you're doing, that's in the computer, mm-hmm. and you guys are just, you know, it's just cranking out data left, right, and sideways.
Yeah.
Are you able to take that modeling stuff and see it play out in real time, or is it still just in the modeling phase?
Yeah, so there's a few different ways you can do that. There's a new software that some collaborators of ours at Lawrence Livermore developed, for example, called PopGlass, mm-hmm. Which is basically you can take in a simulation from mm-hmm. our Popsicle simulation. You can say, all right, if this – for now, we'll pretend that this is truth. When you have a light curve, a new light curve that comes in, mm-hmm. You can model it. You can model what the time scale is. And you can say, okay, you have some – it's not just going to be one value. It'll be some probability distribution of what the time scale is. And then you can plop it down on what we pretend to be truth.
Okay.
And you can say, okay, what how likely is it to be a black hole or mm-hmm. a star or what? Yeah, and stuff like that. So you can connect the simulations to the data, like as like new data is coming in. Mm-hmm. You can, in real time say, okay, well, based on this simulation, how likely is this object to be a black hole or whatever?
So what it sounds like what you're saying, and correct me if I'm wrong, that the purpose of the modeling software is to help you decipher what you're seeing in real space by you just keep feeding it data, and it kind of figures out eventually, says, yeah, this is pretty much a black hole, or this is stars. And then so when you're looking at the stars, you go, yeah, that's a black hole.
Yeah, I think for the most part, for the most part, we wouldn't take that. Any black holes that came out of that, we'd say are black hole candidates, right? Because they might say, oh, this is an 80% chance of being a black hole.
Okay.
And until we do that astrometric follow-up that I mentioned, I don't think we would say this is for sure a black hole.
So the 80% candidates, do they get elevated to 100% with the astrometrics?
Yeah.
Oh,
or maybe
okay.
not necessarily 100%.
95?
But yeah.
Okay.
Like, because basically when you get the astrometric data, you can measure the mass of your lens. And that will also have some probability distribution because, you know, data isn't perfect.
Mm-hmm.
You can measure the mass of your lens. And so if you have something that's supposed to be 10 times the mass of our sun and you don't see a really bright star, then that's very likely to be a black hole.
Okay. So in the course of your research, mm-hmm. what have there been any things that you've observed or things that surprised you or you know, like made your mind go, I can't even wrap my brain around what I'm seeing. What was something that you like really sort of awed you or impressed you as you're studying this stuff?
Yeah, one thing that was really cool is this type of gravitational lensing is called gravitational microlensing, right? Because mm-hmm. the idea is, I didn't talk about was what I didn't talk about was strong gravitational lensing, which is when you have, like, sometimes it's a galaxy lensing a whole other galaxy.
Ooh.
And you can see these gorgeous arcs from that, like, distant galaxy.
That seems like it would sparkle.
Yeah, you can, if you just look up gravitational lensing, you can just see, like, all sorts of these galaxies being mm-hmm. lensed. Microlensing, though, our telescopes are, for the most part, not good enough to be able to resolve those arcs, right? You'd still get the same ones from a black hole lensing a star, but mm-hmm. instead you just see that brightening effect because all of the images from your original source are blended together. But at a recent conference, I saw there's this telescope and I believe Chile, that has started to be able to actually resolve the images from, like, I think that it's a star lensing another star.
Uh-huh.
But I didn't quite realize, I guess, the scale that, we're starting to be able to actually, if they're really, really bright, mm-hmm. You can actually measure the images from the star. And from just those, like, images, you can tell so much from your original star. You can, like, immediately figure out the mass of your lens. You can immediately figure out if it's
real,
or you're more likely to be able to figure out if it's a binary or not.
So what is it about this telescope in Chile? Is it a brand new thing, or is it something? What makes it be able to do things that other telescopes couldn't do up until then?
Yeah, so it uses what's called interferometry.
I have no idea what that is.
So instead of it being one big physical telescope, they actually have four telescopes
uh-huh.
that are all linked together. Those telescopes are all linked together. And so you can, if you have a really bright object, you can kind of have a telescope that's the size of all four of them together.
Okay.
And you're not just taking one image, but you can correlate the images from all four of them and get much more resolution power than any okay. single one alone.
Okay. That actually made sense to me. I'm surprised. So they can now, like, and are they printing images that everyone can see?
I believe that their images are mostly private, but I think that the most recent paper on, I think that they've published the results from the, yeah, being able to actually resolve those images in the last year.
Okay. You're listening to 89.5 FM KPOO San Francisco. We're speaking with Natasha Abrams, who's a fourth year astrophysicist PhD student at my alma mater, UC Berkeley. Go Bears. So for people out there, like, there are a bajillion people who mm-hmm. love astronomy, you up and down the chain. If you were to offer up people, like, for people who are interested in astronomy,
yeah.
what kinds of things do you recommend for them to, or, like, are there events that they can go to? Are you guys doing anything?
Yeah, so at Berkeley, the first Thursday of every month between April and November, so the next one will be the first week of April,
mm-hmm.
we have Astro Night, which is an open, free, public observing night at
cool.
Berkeley in
okay.
Campbell Hall, where we'll have a lecture from sometimes a grad student or a researcher or a professor on campus.
Uh-huh.
And then afterward, we'll have open observing if the weather is nice.
Oh, okay.
On the top of, on the roof of Campbell Hall.
Very cool. And how to, so do you have to register for that?
Nope.
Or can you just show up?
You can just show up.
Boom, boom, boom. Go to Campbell Hall. When is it again? The first Thursday of?
Thursday of every month from April through November. So the next one will be the first week of April.
Very cool. And then if you were going to recommend a book for people to, or a publication for people to learn more about astronomy, to sort of open it up for the people who are really interested, what's your go-to?
Yeah, so I guess depends on exactly what your goal is. I think that something that I wish I had known earlier, is that there exist review articles when mm-hmm. you are interested in, you know, if you're interested in a particular subject and you want to, like, look at the literature, the cutting edge literature and mm-hmm. stuff like this. Mm-hmm. And it's like, oh my God, none of these terms are defined. It's going to take a million years to go through this. Mm-hmm. Then there exists like these annual review articles where they get people to kind of review like consensus of a field mm-hmm. and including like some definitions like that, is more in depth than like a popular science like book or article, but is not as or is more accessible than like kind of the day to day this research is being published.
Okay. And where do you find these?
I think if you just look up annual review astronomy, then things will come up. You might have to go through, I guess, a library because sometimes I think sometimes there can be money involved. But you might have to go through a library to get it for free. But I think it's possible.
And then now, so you talked about your dad just making up facts. Now, do you ever, like when your parents now ask you stuff, do you ever make up facts and then go, no, that's not true at all?
I think my dad's more than a jokester. I generally try and I'll try and come up with analogies that make it easier to understand.
Okay, but I'm sure they're like, over the moon, no pun intended, that this passion of yours is that you're following it and that you're focused on truth and scientific rigor. And so
yeah, for sure.
Very, very happy. So. Well, Natasha, is there anything that you want our listening audience to know before we wrap our interview up?
It's awesome that facts are so easily accessible and there's lots of textbooks and papers and all this. If you, I'd encourage you to learn if you're interested in learning. I think astronomy can be a very accessible field if you want it to be. So.
Excellent. Well, Natasha Abrams, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today.
And thank you for having me.
People of Earth, because I do say that all the time. People of Earth, that was great. Black holes, science. There are objective truths. There are truths that are still waiting to be revealed. There are people who make it their mission to try and actually figure out what's really going on in terms of how things work. How do the heavens work? How does gravity work? How do all of these things work? And it's there, so that truth is there so that you can make informed decisions. So you can make informed decisions by going and finding reputable sources to help explain the things that you don't understand, and also to point out any places where there are disagreements so that you know that not everything is 100% known, but they're willing to try and find out what is known. It is 12:52 here at 89.5 FM KPOO San Francisco, and I feel like I want us to listen to some songs about stars. So we're going to start off with a dancey one. This, my friends, Earth, Wind, and Fire. Who knew? Shining Star.